Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Hello and a warm welcome to DW's Africa Link program, coming to you live from our studios here in Bonn, Germany. I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm Eddie Micah Jr. Remember, we're also live on our Facebook page, DW Africa Link. You can share your thoughts on the stories that we're covering and we'll read some of your comments. Coming up, Amnesty International has again accused oil giants Shell and Eni of negligence when addressing oil spills in Nigeria. We hear from one of those who've been affected by the spills.
If you go to our farm, oil have destroyed many things that we cannot farm again. So we are very hungry and we want federal government to come.
And South Africa's former president Jacob Zuma is to face prosecution for 16 charges of corruption. That's according to the chief prosecutor, Sean Abrahams.
After consideration of the matter, I am of the view that there are reasonable prospects of a successful prosecution of Mr. Zuma on the charges listed.
These are some of the stories we've lined up for you, but first, here's a chance to listen to what's been happening around the world.
I am Kai Dombach with the DW News. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov announced Friday that he would expel British diplomats from the country. This comes after the UK said it would expel 23 Russian diplomats after a former Russian spy and his daughter were poisoned in the UK, which the UK blames on Russia. Lavrov accused the UK of having no evidence that Russia was behind the poisoning.
Skripal-то жив, и дочка его жива. И, наверное, они...
Skripal is alive, so is his daughter. Hopefully, they will survive and will be able to provide details about what happened. Nobody wants to wait for that. Everything is already decided. We will not show you anything, said our British colleagues. We know everything, you just have to confess it, and after that, we will punish you.
The Zimbabwean government has dismissed claims from former President Robert Mugabe that he was forced out in a coup. Mugabe also said the current government should be undone during his first public comments since he was forced to resign.
We must undo this disgrace which we have imposed on ourselves. We don't deserve it. We don't deserve it. Please, we don't deserve it. Zimbabwe doesn't deserve it. We want to be a constitutional country. Yes, we may have our shortcomings here and there, but overall, we must obey the law.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel is meeting with French President Emmanuel Macron in Paris to discuss Eurozone reform. Macron's finance minister supports a Eurozone finance minister and an independent budget for the single currency bloc, while Merkel's conservative bloc is skeptical of the plan. This news comes to you from Deutsche Welle, Germany's international public broadcaster. South Africa's chief prosecutor said he would charge former President Jacob Zuma with 16 counts of corruption. The charges stem from a $2.5 billion arms purchase in 1999 when Zuma was deputy president.
In the interests of transparency, the interests of the administration of justice, and in the interests of the National Prosecuting Authority, I am of the view that a trial court would be the most appropriate forum for these issues to be ventilated and to be decided upon. After consideration of the matter, I am of the view that there are reasonable prospects of a successful prosecution of Mr. Zuma on the charges listed in the indictment.
Russian, Iranian, and Turkish foreign ministers met in the Kazakh capital of Astana to focus on the eastern Ghouta region, which is home to an opposition enclave in the ongoing Syrian conflict. Both Russia and Iran support the Syrian government, but Turkey has called for an end to the offensive in the region, which has left more than 1,000 dead and forced tens of thousands to flee. Human rights organization Amnesty International accused the Shell and Eni oil companies of negligence when addressing oil spills in Nigeria. Amnesty International said the two companies took weeks to respond to reports of spills and downplaying the severity, which cut off compensation for affected communities. Both Shell and Eni, which have been active in the Niger Delta region for decades, have denied the claims. For more news and information, please visit our website at dw.com. I'm Kai Dombach.
You are listening to DW's Africa Link program coming to you live from our studios in Bonn, Germany. I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm Eddie Micah Jr. We begin today's program in Nigeria, where Amnesty International has accused oil giants Shell and Eni of negligence when addressing spills in Nigeria. Describing their actions as serious negligence, Amnesty said the companies were taking weeks to respond to reports of spills and publishing misleading information about the cause and severity of spills, which may result in communities not receiving compensation. A Shell spokesman said Amnesty's allegations are false, without merit, and fail to recognize the complex environment in which the company operates. Our correspondent in the Niger Delta, Mohammed Bello, filed in this report.
Oil spills in the Niger Delta region have brought more misery to many locals for many years. The oil itself that was supposed to be a blessing has become a curse. Profits often repatriated by foreign companies like Shell and Eni, largely responsible for the oil spills and providing false information on the spills, according to Amnesty International. James Awani, an indigenous of Ogoniland in the oil region, where Shell is alleged to have caused a massive oil spill, told DW how the spills affected his livelihood.
If you go to our farm, oil have destroyed many things that we cannot farm again. So we are very hungry and we want federal government to come and do something for us.
Tammy Williams, also a native of the oil region, accused oil companies in the region of not being considerate of the people in the region, hence causing massive pollution.
The oil companies in the Niger Delta, they have been so very unfair to the Niger Delta, as in guarding oil spills and not performing their statutory duties to the communities. It's terrible.
Ankyo Briggs, an environmental activist in the Niger Delta region, had this to say on this latest report by Amnesty International.
Well, this is not strange. I also, my organization collects data. We physically go into the areas of spill. Agape Birthrights organization. We have documentation going back 20 years almost of different spills across the Niger Delta, River State, Bayelsa, Delta State, and all of that, where we can show very clearly that it does take not just weeks, but months sometimes for the oil company to respond to reports of spills. Now, if you look at the fact that pipes were laid 50, almost 60 years ago. Those pipes are still underground. Those pipes were laid at the time when the technology we have today was not in existence, where you can very quickly detect a spill.
Previous research by Amnesty International has revealed that information and reports on oil spills provided by Shell and Eni was often inaccurate. As an instance given by Amnesty, Shell massively understated the amount of oil spilled in the fishing town of Bodo between 2008 and 2009. However, with its help, the Bodo community eventually took legal action, forcing Shell to admit the real amount and pay £55 million in compensation. Amnesty says it will present a detailed report of its findings of the oil spills to the Nigerian government. I contacted Shell Oil Company management over the Amnesty International claims on the oil spills, but said it was too early for them to respond as they require time to study the report.
That was DW's correspondent Mohammed Bello reporting from the Niger Delta.
Now, Eddie, these oil spills have been going on for quite a long time in the Niger Delta region. And of course, the main suspects, as usual, that these oil giants, Shell and Eni, and locals there, I mean, bear the brunt, you know.
Exactly. And I mean, they are denying it. They're saying what the report has brought out is not true. But then why delay, you know, the response that they want from them? So it's quite a tricky situation.
Yeah, it's a story that we've been covering for many years, you know, and the locals there, their fields where they used to plant, you know, crops, you know, are totally destroyed because of the pollution. And of course, some of them, because fish is part of the menu, you can't catch any fish in the Niger Delta anymore.
No, not
because of the oil. Anyway, tell us what you think about what can be done, you know, with these oil giants. Just go to our Facebook page, DW Africa, and start the debate. Now, this weekend, Russians will head to the polls to vote in the 7th presidential election since the collapse of the Soviet Union in December 1991. 8 candidates are running in the race, including the incumbent president, Vladimir Putin, who seems poised to win his 4th term in the Kremlin. Shortly before we came on air, I spoke to DW's Emily Shawin in Moscow, and I asked him whether Putin is likely to win in the upcoming elections.
Yeah, I think it's pretty safe to say, Isaac, that Putin will win these upcoming elections. Current surveys show him polling at around 70%. And as you say, it will be his fourth term as president. Now, Vladimir Putin is still popular after all these years. He's seen as kind of a symbol for stability here in Russia. You have to remember that Putin came to power in 2000. And Russians remember the 1990s after the fall of the Soviet Union as a really traumatic time. There were economic difficulties, there was crime, there was chaos. And Putin is seen as having brought stability after that very difficult and traumatic time. And he's also seen as having restored national pride after the fall of the Soviet Union. And people really like that he kind of is seen as not giving in to Western pressure. So Putin is very much still popular, and polls show that he's very, very likely to win and to perhaps even have a landslide.
Well put, Emily. Now, while Russia is currently facing a diplomatic crisis abroad, with the UK expelling 23 Russian diplomats over a nerve agent attack against a former spy, how much support is Putin getting back home in the middle of all this crisis?
Well, this crisis kind of plays into Putin's hand. This whole idea that there's a Western anti-Russian campaign going on, that almost rallies people behind Putin. And as I said, Putin is popular because he's seen as making Russia strong in the face of adversity and despite this isolation from the West. So that whole narrative could perhaps drum up support for Putin in the run-up to the election. And we've seen him very much use it in the campaign as well.
I was speaking to Emily Sherwin in Moscow on Putin's likely win in the upcoming elections. Now, Eddie, we have some comments, surprisingly, on our Facebook page. People are talking about Russian elections on Sunday.
Exactly. Well, Andy Brown starts. He says Putin has won with 120% of the vote.
Andy Brown, you know, already put it at 120%. Although our correspondent Emily, as you heard, said perhaps a landslide with 70%. Mm-hmm. Many thanks, Andy, for that comment. Khalid Swede says, because none would dare to stand as an opponent of him.
Mm-hmm. Well, Natalia Kontovich says, isn't it obvious because there's no elections or the system is designed to make sure Putin stays in power?
Surprisingly, Eddie, like we heard from our correspondent, you know, whatever is happening at the moment, you know, the isolation from the West or Europe, it's working in favor of mm-hmm. Putin himself.
They see him as a strong leader. They see him as not kowtowing to pressure from the West, and that's exactly why it looks like he may go on to win. Anyway, moving on to other stories, this time in South Africa. Former South African President Jacob Zuma will face prosecution on corruption charges that haunted much of his term in office, the country's chief prosecutor has announced. The former president could now appeal the ruling on a number of grounds and argue that the decision is illegitimate, as Abraham's own position is uncertain. In December, the High Court in Pretoria ordered then-Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa to replace Abrahams, ruling that Zuma's original decision to appoint him was null and void because he was conflicted at the time. Zuma's criminal charges related to multi-billion dollar arms procurement deals struck by the government in the late 1990s, and from which he's accused of profiting corruptly to the tune of 4 million rands, approximately that $345,000. This is South Africa's chief prosecutor, Sean Abraham, making the announcement.
After consideration of the matter, I am of the view that there are reasonable prospects of a successful prosecution of Mr. Zuma on the charges listed in the indictment served on Mr. Zuma prior to the termination of the matter by Mshe SC. As a result, Mr. Zuma's representations are unsuccessful. The Director of Public Prosecutions, KwaZulu-Natal, will facilitate the necessary processes for Mr. Zuma and his co-accused to appear in court. Lastly, an application for the permanent stay of the prosecution of Mr. Zuma has recently been filed in the Cape High Court by an NGO. I, along with the National Prosecuting Authority, have been cited as respondents in this matter. I've instructed the state attorney to brief senior counsel to oppose this application.
That was South Africa's chief prosecutor, Sean Abraham.
Looks like Jacob Zuma has 9 lives like that of a cat. Anyway, go to Facebook page and tell us what you think about this story.
Welcome back to the program. I'm Eddie Micah Jr.
And I'm Isaac Mugabe. You're also live on Facebook page, DW Africa. Go there and keep the debate flowing. Coming up in the next 15 minutes, Israel's Supreme Court temporarily suspends the government's plans to deport Eritrean and Sudanese migrants. We'll be hearing from someone who's been following up this case. Eddie, I think this is kind of relief to the migrants, isn't it?
It is, only temporarily though. So We'll have to wait and see how things go. But also coming up today on African Roots, we bring you the story of Senegalese scholar Sheikh Anta Diop. But before all of that, we move to Israel, where the country's Supreme Court has suspended the contentious government's plan to deport thousands of Eritrean and Sudanese migrants. The court has given the state until March 26 to provide further information. And until then, the suspension on deporting the migrants to a third country would remain in place. Now, this comes after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced in January the implementation of the program to remove migrants who entered illegally, giving them a choice between leaving voluntarily or being forced out. Now, I earlier spoke to Dror Sadot, who is the spokesperson of the NGO Hotline for Refugees and Migrants in Israel. I first asked her how the courts reached this decision and what exactly they demanded of the government to put it into effect.
Well, the Supreme Court decision came out because of an appeal of two lawyers, Itai Mack and Victor Feldman. They both made an appeal against this deportation plan of Israel. So when the hearing was last week, and the Supreme Court opinion was that the state came unready and they didn't prepare themselves for the hearing. And this is why they went back to the state and told them there are things that are not were not clear about the agreement. Until then, that they won't deport anyone.
What exactly are the migrants saying?
It gives them hope, and they're really determined to make this over. They're trying to encourage the people who already been jailed to say, we're behind you, we're taking care of you, we hope it will be over soon.
In the worst case scenario, on the 26th of March, which again is 10 days away, that the court then says, well, we have enough information from the government and this deportation process should go on.
Well, not exactly, because this hearing, we're talking about really a temporary decision before even the state made an argument. I believe that it will take weeks until there will be a real decision in this appeal. Right now we're talking about a temporary decision until the state will complete their arguments. It will be a long hearing, this is what I believe.
What do you foresee in the near future is going to be the result of all of this?
Well, I believe, as I see right now what's going on in the public, that we're going to win this fight. I think that everyone understands right now that the solution of deportation is just unreasonable. There's no real reason to keep on going with this deportation. It's not moral, it's not legal, it's even not economical. I mean, it's not... No one benefits from this deportation, and I believe that because we have another solutions, they're talking about, you know, spreading all over the country, we're talking about receiving, giving status, and things that we're saying all the time. But right now, it's really, we're getting to this point that people understand that just giving them a legal status, just, you know, examine their asylum requests under international standards, to give them jobs, to spread and, you know, take care of them. This is the only reasonable solution. And I believe that more and more that we're going on with this fight, people understand it. And I believe that also the government will in the end understand this.
That was spokesperson of the Israel-based NGO Hotline for Refugees and Migrants, Dror Sadot.
And we have comments that you've been, you know, posting on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Diplomat George Dick says, in the recent World Happiness Report 2018, Israel is ranked 11th happiest country in the world. But this year, they also measured happiness ranking for immigrants. And guess what? Israel is ranked 12th in immigrants' happiness before Ireland, US, UK, and even Luxembourg. Okay, sometimes these reports beat my understanding. And, you know, Eddie, I mean, this report also said Israel is among the countries that are less tolerant of migrants and that do not accept migrants openly.
Yeah.
So tell me about the happiness anyway.
Exactly. I mean, we could go on and on about this.
Yeah.
More comments going on. Nazreen can ask, were African immigrants in mass concentration camps also interviewed? I think not, because you first have to count them as human.
Oof. Exactly. Anyway, keep the debate. I like it. I like it when people debate, you know, on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Keep it flowing. And we will be back right after this.
DW, African Roots.
And yes, it's time for the African Roots, our series. We bring you the story of Cheikh Anta Diop, a Senegalese scholar who was involved for the struggle of independence in his country. In his book, Negro Nations and Culture, Anta Diop inspired many Africans and intellectuals at the time to be proud of their heritage, spearheaded a complete rewrite of African history devoid of racist prejudices. This report by Tamara Vakenagel is now presented by Wanjiko Maura. It starts with archived sound of Cheikh Anta Diop recorded way back in 1974.
Cette humanité qui est née en Afrique, cette humanité est née aux sources du fleuve Nil.
This humanity that was born in Africa, this humanity was born at the sources of the Nile River. It was deep black. Then this humanity progressively colonized the valley, and it had 120,000 years in front of it to go down from the region of Uganda to the Nile Delta.
De la région de l'Ouganda au delta du Nil.
The ancient Egyptian culture, so admired by the Western world, has been influenced by people coming from sub-Saharan Africa. Sheikh Anta Diop revealed these findings in 1954. His demonstration was based on solid scientific arguments, such as the linguistic proximity between ancient Egyptian and other African languages. It caused a stir in the scientific community, where racist prejudices were and are still very common. His theories were revolutionary at the time, explains Abubakar Musa, professor at the Sheikh Anta Diop University in Dakar and Egyptology specialist.
Ce travail, Cheikh Anta le publie en 1954 sous le titre de...
This work, Card publishes it in 1954 under the title Negro Nations and Culture. It became an uncontrollable bomb. Negro Nations and Culture became the bedside book of every African intellectual in training and of every intellectual of the diaspora. Of course, Westerners did everything they could to discredit the book.
On tout fait pour discréditer le livre.
Discrediting the book proved difficult because of Diop's determination. Not only did Diop excel in literary works, but he also had been a brilliant student in chemistry, nuclear physics, and philosophy. But as fate would have it, Sheikh Anta Diop had a passion for history and linguistics and liked to tackle major issues, says history professor Babacar Diop from the University of Dakar.
Il s'est penché sur des questions très complexes.
He dealt with very complex issues, with the issue of national languages, with the question of federalism in Africa, with energy issues. He was visionary. He set many benchmarks, and I think it is not possible today to talk about Africa's history, or even about human history, without mentioning Sheikh Anta's writings.
Sheikh Anta Diop was interested in Africa's future as he was in its past. As a student, he was committed to pro-independence student movements and in the 1960s, supported by multi-partyism and democracy in Senegal, he traveled throughout Africa to call upon Africans to unite politically, economically, and culturally, whether in politics or in science. Sheikh Anta Diop stood out by his uncompromising attitude. His determination helped to strike the decisive blow to the falsification of the human history inherited from the colonial past. Between 1964 and 1999, UNESCO gradually published a general history of Africa in which the findings of the visionary scholar Anta Diop have an important part.
That report on African Roots was written by Tamara Vaknagel, and African Roots returns next Friday. Now, as usual, every Friday we give you another dose of sports, and Eddie is here excited to tell you what's on the menu.
Exactly. It's a mouth-watering stuff that's on the menu. So, well, the Champions League semi-final draw has been made, with some very interesting clashes to be expected. After kicking out Manchester United from the competition, Sevilla will try to do the same against high-flying Bayern Munich. Now, Real Madrid have also been drawn against Juventus. Now, with the two remaining English clubs, Manchester United and Liverpool, playing each other, who is going to remain? Now, Barcelona, I should say, would also lock horns with AS Roma. So I spoke to Chuck Penfold from the DW Sports Desk and sought his opinion on the draw. I first asked him what he expected from the fixture between Bayern Munich and Sevilla.
They've avoided the teams they probably really didn't want to face. They avoided Barcelona. They avoided Real Madrid. They avoided Manchester City, I should say, of the Premier League. And Juventus would have been a tough one as well. So I think Bayern probably won't admit it, but this probably was a good draw for them.
Yeah, definitely. Now, also Barcelona, welcome AS Roma. Is this going to continue to be the Messi show?
Yeah, I think it probably will. Barcelona sort of firing in all cylinders. And Messi, of course, just this week, scored its 100th goal in the Champions League. So to me, everything's pointing towards Barcelona making it to the semifinals and probably the final.
Real Madrid would also want to question that. Hopefully they'll get into the finals. They're going to be playing against Juventus. Now, if they want to make it three consecutive Champions League trophies, they must do away with Juventus.
Yeah, Juventus are tough, as my team Tottenham found out in the last round. They're tough defensively and a really strong team, top of Serie A. So that should be a real test for Real Madrid.
English fans are worried because only one team will progress to the next stage now, as Liverpool will be playing against Manchester City. Big clash.
Well, English fans shouldn't be worried. They can be happy that so many of their teams got so far in Europe. It's a lot different for us here in Germany. That's a big clash. Of course, Jürgen Klopp, the German coach, is Liverpool. I think you have to give the edge to Manchester City, though, the way they've been just blowing away everybody pretty much this season.
However, though, in the Premier League, Liverpool are the only ones that have defeated Manchester City.
That's true. So that's another sort of example of why we play the games. But I still think on the day, Manchester City, they should come out on top.
Back to the Bundesliga, Bayern Munich can wrap up a sixth straight Bundesliga title with a win away at RB Leipzig on Sunday evening. Now, that depends on if Schalke and Borussia Dortmund all fail to win, then this will be the Bavarians' earliest ever title triumph. You see that happening?
Yeah, it could well happen. Bayern have just, it's been a funny season for them in a way, because they started out the season, of course, with Carlo Ancelotti in charge, didn't have a great start, and then there was that game in Paris where they really didn't look good and Ancelotti was gone within hours. And they brought back the old man, Jupp Heynckes. He's 72 now. He's the last guy that led them to the triple in 2013, or the treble, and they've been firing on all cylinders since then. And it could happen this weekend. If it doesn't happen this weekend, it's just a matter of time, because they're so far 20 points clear on the table.
The squad names are out. The German national team players. Any surprises there? Marco Reus is not part of it.
A little bit of a surprise maybe too was that Mario Götze, the guy, of course, who scored the World Cup winning goal in 2014, has been left out. So that's a bit of a surprise. Of course, Neuer's not there, the goalkeeper. He's still injured. But other than that, no real big surprises.
That was Chuck Penfold from DW Sports Desk.
Now let the matches begin. I mean, I like that round of the last eight. And of course, just like you mentioned, I mean, high-flying Bayern Munich, I think they're really flying, you know. And do you think really on your Sevilla can stop them?
I mean,
I heard you say that.
Yeah,
the thing is, it's football. You never know what happens. No one expected Sevilla to be able to beat Mourinho's Manchester United.
Look, I watched the game and from the start, it looked like, you know, Manchester United was whizzing away. There were not so much concentration of the game, them on the pitch. They only remembered to play at the end after conceding one goal, you know.
It was too late by then.
It was too late. Mourinho tried to bring in Martial and taking off, you know, Fellaini and bring in Pogba. Look, both of them have not been fit for the last 10 days.
But I was like, you know which team I'm rooting for, if I have to say? Real Madrid.
And you know which team I'm rooting for? What? And then the reason is Bayern Munich, because, well, I live in Germany. What should I?
Okay.
But, well, partly I'm for Real Madrid. And because of Zidane, isn't that?
For sure.
Not the team, and that's me. Anyway, with that, we come to the end of this show of Africa Link. And on behalf of the Taking Code crew behind there, I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm Eddie Micah Jr.
Wishing you a splendid weekend ahead.